Chairman Dack, although I served on Sea Alaska Board for 7 years, I know exactly how they operate. And I know that a lot of people are looking to the corporations for benefits. It looks very vague that they will ever receive any for some time. Especially the elderly people will pass on before they see any benefits. And it's the elderly people that brought these things about, and we fail to recognize them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. In order to look to the future, we have to know something about the past. And at this time on the agenda, we have Gil Truitt with the overview of Native education history in Sitka.
Thank you, Ellen. This afternoon I asked Andy how long he thought tonight's meeting would last. His answer was that it would last probably all night because nothing but old people are on the agenda. And I assume he was talking about his Aunt Ellen and Mark, Isabel and Bill. Those on the panel this evening, those of us who have been around Sitka for a number of years, know that Bill Brady graduated from Wrangell Institute, that Andy and Ellen and Mark graduated from Sheldon Jackson School, and that Franco Williams and myself graduated from Mount Edgecombe. That is going to be the topic. But like the agenda states, it's going to be an overview of the education really in Southeast rather than confined to Sitka. And as I cover each very briefly, the comparisons that I make, if any, will be only the times that I attended those schools, keeping in mind too that schools changed in different years. That certainly was true of the number of years that I spent at Mount Edgecombe. By the time I reached Wrangell Institute, that also was going through a change. And the years after I left Sheldon Jackson, there was a change. Maybe my being there caused the change to be better, because I left Sheldon Jackson in strange circumstances, which I will mention later. Something that I learned and something that benefited me up to this point. The remarks that I will make about Wrangell Institute and Sheldon Jackson will be brief. I should mention that 14 years ago I did write a history. While in graduate school on Sheldon Jackson and also Mount Edgecombe, and did not complete the one on Wrangell Institute. 30 years after the purchase of Alaska, there still was no system of educating natives of Alaska. Actually, I think we can extend that by as many as 50 years, because education for the native youngsters in the state of Alaska was very limited, and even more so up north. I often wondered in the early years of Mount Edgecombe, as did some of my schoolmates, we often wondered where were the kids from up north, because probably 90% of the students from 1947 up to, I would say, around 1953, that great percentage was made up from students in Southeast. What was happening up north? The only conclusion that can be reached at this date is nothing. And I think the northern parts of Alaska still is suffering from no education as late as 1947, when Mount Edgecombe opened. Now, when I started school here in Sitka, in the old BIA school, which is only about a block from here, it was permissible in that era for us to attend public schools. Now, keep in mind that only a few years prior to that, it was not permissible for Native people to attend public school. One of the big test cases locally involved Isabel Brady's older brother, Henry Singh. He was the test case. William Paul handled that case. And William Paul lost the case because of the mixed blood Henry Singh being not full-blooded Lincoln. And Henry Singh lost a full year of school because of that. Now, when we started, and I believe Mark was young enough, and Isabel, that it would have been possible for us to attend Sitka High School. There were a number of Native families that were attending Sitka High School when we started in the old BIA school. Now, we hear a lot about things being tough today. Young people, and I'm talking about teenagers, really have no idea what those my age and the generation before mine that had to put up with just to get an education. Now, it was permissible when I graduated from eighth grade here to enroll at Sitka High School. I could remember the coach from Sitka High School coming down here to the school, talking to people like Herb Diedrichson, Henry Benson, my brother Joe, Lawrence Woodmark, Henry Benson, myself, trying to talk us into going to Sitka High School. And of course, he was interested in basketball because in those days, anybody was beating Sitka High School, including sixth graders at the elementary school here. Now, in all the years that I've been involved in education with the BIA, and keep in mind, too, that I have said all those years as much, and I meant what I said when I made positive statements about the BIA. But with my long involvement, there is one thing that I noticed. It seemed to me and others that whenever the school was improving and was proving to be highly successful with the Native people, there seemed to be the part of the BIA to sabotage that movement. 2 years after I started teaching at Mount Edgecombe, one of the most successful, two successful programs, three, you want to include academics, was the vocational shop and the business department. Both were producing people who moved immediately into the job market. But we saw the vocational department virtually eliminated. We saw the business department virtually eliminated. And then we saw, just recently, a year ago, Mount Edgecombe close. There is no doubt of the success of the school. It puzzled many of us even today when you look at one or two other BIA schools that they chose to leave open. Now, there were very few options for those my age to go on beyond the secondary level. If you went to school, you did it yourself. There were no grants from the territory, the state today, nothing from the BIA. And when you look at Sheldon Jackson, you look at Mount Edgecombe, both institutions provided the opportunities that if anyone or most anyone wanted to pursue higher education, they already were given the opportunities by those two great institutions. If the grants were available, scholarships available then as they are today, we would see, I think, a different Alaska today. But the short period of time that our people started going to college, and we can talk about vocational school, but it's the college-educated person who makes the mark. This is shown all over the state of Alaska from Mount Edgecombe graduates. But there really were no options, beginning with the eighth grade. When you graduate from the BIA school here, you either went to Sheldon Jackson or Wrangell Institute. No one here cared to go to Sitka High School. Now, one of the difficulties I noticed with youngsters when I was in the BIA school was that a good number of our schoolmates from the village had much difficulty with the English language. And sadly, none of them succeeded. Many dropped out no farther than the third grade, some the second grade, and they were doomed to failure the rest of their life. Now, those of us in the BIA school here were extremely lucky. Those ahead of me, I believe Bill Brady's era, had Mr. Ryder. I understand he was strict. I came into the school when Mr. Raymond Wolf, the same year he arrived, and I left a year after he left. Now, this was an individual who treated us as people. He did not look upon us as natives or as poor, nor did he feel sorry for us. His job was to teach. He stressed punctuality and attendance. And if you fell down in either of these two areas, your parents were visited. He stressed a lot of work, high quality work, and did not stereotype the native youngsters, which is one of the faults I have seen with many people, many teachers coming up from the South 48. They look at our native youngsters and immediately they do several things. One is they feel sorry about these poor native kids who come to us from a poor background. The Wolves did not take that attitude. They treated all of us alike. And one of the things I remember about that school was they had high expectations of the native kids, and you produced or else. Now, the or else or part was that if you were not up to their level, the standards that they set for us, we slow ones, which included everybody, stayed in school until 4th of July. But we learned from these people. I was fortunate to have some teachers like Laura Walton, Lila Strand, Flora Cook, all Native women who had the same philosophy as Raymond Wolf. They also had a good sense of humor, especially Flora Cook, Flora Jacobs. Then, in our later years, Ember Demmer joined the staff. He was like these three women, but his character was different. Kind, but that did not mean that the students did not have the same respect for Mr. Ember Demmer as we did for the three women. As I started teaching after the first year, I made it a point to see these four people, to tell them how much I appreciated what a good job they did as teachers. It's extremely important that the elementary teachers be dedicated, because that is the beginning. Just as when you have a child, it's important that you train them before they're even able to walk. Otherwise, you will lose them. I attended Sheldon Jackson during what we like to call the golden era or golden period of Sheldon Jackson, which started right from the beginning up to probably the mid-1950s. It was a well-structured school and very disciplined. And in my involvement with Sheldon Jackson, Wrangell Institute, Mount Edgecombe, there is one thing I noticed, that when you had a strong, disciplined leader who demanded the best, you had a good school. You also had good teachers. The product that you produced also was of high quality. That is something Sheldon Jackson did right from the beginning. The leadership is still here. Some are beginning to fade out. But sadly, with the closure of Sheldon Jackson School, the leadership from that school also will begin to fade. That is one of the reasons I think it's extremely important, and this is not a political pitch, that Mount Edgecombe reopen to continue the tradition, Sheldon Jackson and Mount Edgecombe. Now, Sheldon Jackson had rules that were strict. That is one thing the students took pride in, that you had to be good to stay in school. It had a curriculum that was second to none. There, too, the staff treated the students as people, not as natives. And one thing Sheldon Jackson and then Mount Edgecombe were criticized for was not emphasizing native culture. Having been involved, I can see the reasons why. Because Sheldon Jackson drew from all over the state, Mount Edgecombe did the same. Now, when many of those students from the village came to those schools, they were behind. You take the average youngster in the public schools. And I believe Sheldon Jackson, and I'm sure Mount Edgecombe had the same philosophy. They had to make a choice. Do you pursue the native culture, or are we going to educate the young people and prepare them for what's ahead at the risk of being criticized? So you understand the choice that those schools made. It's one of the reasons I've always been hurt by our people criticizing the missionaries, Sheldon Jackson, and then the BIA. And as a teacher, I can see why it's so important that the students learn to speak English. Because if you're going to teach French, they will learn to speak French by speaking French, not English. Sheldon Jackson and then Mount Edgecombe had extremely dedicated teachers. When you look at the pay that those teachers received, it's peanuts compared to what the school system pays its teachers. At Mount Edgecombe, the top pay for teachers was $22,000. You compare that with what Sitka teachers are receiving. When I started at Mount Edgecombe, my pay was almost $5,000. As an administrator, it was far less than $30,000. We at Edgecombe had difficult times within the school, problems, but one of the problems never discussed by teachers, it was never a problem to the teachers, was a discussion on the low pay that we received. That's the reason we know that teachers from Sheldon Jackson and Mount Edgecombe were dedicated. Both were about the same. Many put in long hours beyond 5 o'clock. And I don't want to say that we had poor teachers, because we did. Fortunately for us, those people didn't stay long. When you think of Sheldon Jackson, you think of Dr. Condit, you think of Les Yaw. You also think of Miss Whitmore, one of the great teachers anywhere in the world. She never had any problems because she had the respect of everyone. I could remember when I entered her class, my classmates were Herb Diedrichsen, Lawrence Woodmark, Henry Benson, Irene Jimmy, Fred Boyd. It really was a class. The first day we walked into her class, we were waiting for her. Miss Whitmore eventually came in. She came in with a big club and put it in the corner. She never said anything about the club, but we kept looking at it. Few weeks later, as she was writing on the chalkboard, Herb Diedrichsen, who always sat in the back, was really cutting up and making noise. But she continued to write. Herb was really disturbing the class. But she continued to write, never turned around, and said, "Herbert, if you don't sit down and behave yourself, I'll come back and slug you one. We had no idea how she knew that it was Herb. If Herb was here, I would still mention his name. Now, from the school, you've already heard these mention of these leaders. They were on the scene for years. Now, it was that group of people, Peter Simpson, Ralph Young, and those who followed in the next decade. People like the Widmark brothers, David Howard, Walter Sobeloff. They were the ones in the convention who said it's extremely important that our young people learn to speak English because they are going to be called upon to compete in this world, and they will not be able to do it without a good knowledge of English. They also stated they must learn to read because reading is the key to education, and that is something that has never changed. As I compare Wrangell Institute with Sheldon Jackson, and as I stated earlier, I'm comparing with when I was there. The discipline at Wrangell Institute was stricter than Sheldon Jackson, but academically, it was lacking. What I appreciated about Sheldon Jackson was your day was not done when you left class. You went back to study hall for 2 hours. There is another thing that I noticed between Sheldon Jackson and Wrangell Institute. Something I appreciated at Wrangell Institute. At Sheldon Jackson, I wondered when I was there why we as students did not elect the student council. The staff appointed the student council. I could remember Buddy Widmark and I going to see Mr. Yaw, and we asked why did we not elect them. He told us who was the boss. That ended any questions. The first day I was at Wrangell Institute, I was amazed and impressed. The assembly, we, the students, elected our student council. I also noticed at Wrangell Institute was everyone there was poor. Maybe that is the reason I was more at home at Wrangell Institute. That same thing occurred at Wrangell at Mount Edgecombe, that the majority of the students were poor. Many had no money. Maybe that's the reason that the students from Mount Edgecombe are such a tightly and close-knit group. You see this all over the state when you travel. Mount Edgecombe, as everyone here is aware, opened in 1947. The reason for this was Wrangell Institute and Eklutna were both BIA schools being closed, because Mount Edgecombe provided the better facilities. Now, when I look at the school, I can see three periods of the school. One was from 1947 to 1964, an extremely good period. Then I look at the second period, 1964 to 1965, absolutely the worst period in the history of that school. If the BIA ever wanted to close the school, I felt that that was going to be the period. Then the last period, 1976 to 1983, was as good as the first period. The difference between the good and the weak periods were the superintendents. Mount Edgecombe had 8 superintendents. 6 were strict and educators. 2 were poor and extremely bad. The last superintendent was strong. That is when the school began to straighten out and became what we were at the beginning. And Lee Demert, this is something I tell many people, that I think you did an outstanding job the years that you were at Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe became the melting pot of the state. You see this in travels. A few years ago, I was up in Bethel. Their gymnasium is much bigger than Sitka's. But the village people all came into Mount Edgecombe to see the Mount Edgecombe Band, approximately 2,500 people. The last song that the band played was the song everyone from Edgecombe knows, and that was the school song. When they played that number, the gymnasium erupted, and they had to play that song the band leader said 5 times. It got so wild that some of our kids who were in the band got up and led our big alumni in singing that song. I think of all the years that those band members attended Mount Edgecombe, that was the one that touched them the most. Those of us who attended the school know what it's meant when we say it was a family. It's a family that many of us would like to see reopen. It's a school that did not worry about tribal affiliation until recent years. It was also a school that did not need to take a back seat because of its outstanding curriculum and the caliber of teachers who were there. I've always regretted the fact that I felt, along with those in the Mount Edgecombe community, that Sitka, the community, never really knew what was happening at Edgecombe. We are proud to have been a part of it, and I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to speak this evening. I only hope to have a part in helping reopen Mount Edgecombe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gil. As a part of the Native education topic, Isabella Brady is next, and then followed by Bill.
Gnofchish, Yedikuk Ah Yuchatu Vasak, Yesh Kiks Adi. My borrowed name is Isabella Brady. I'm Tlingit, Tsimshian, and Chinese. Thank you for this opportunity to share my views on Indian education. For this commission, I'd like to welcome you, Judge Berger and Eileen McLean. It's been a pleasure to be with you. First of all, I'd like to say that Esther Littlefield says we've always had Indian education. It's not something that started with the coming of the white man. I divided mine into various areas of Native education or Indian education. The earliest area was the Tlingit area. And we had the oral traditions at that time, and I'll make a few more comments about it. And the fact that they taught the children the ways of the men, the women, and the arts, the music, the dance, the clothing, the food, there was much that our people did that was very good. I feel that we've come around full circle on our back, not all the way, but partially to where we started in regard to the appreciation for our food. I'd like to mention, too, that culture is a way of life. It's not something that you learn or try to do. It's just a way of life. The Russian era, the strange part about this was the fact that the Russians treated the Tlingits a lot nicer than the white man did, or the Americans when they came. They tried to write the Tlingit language. They had their liturgy, their songs, in the language. They tried to train young people. They didn't try to stamp out the language. Another area that we come into is the one of the United States and the Alaskan Territory, which is the worst part of our history that we have. It's kind of ironic that we became citizens in 1924. So you need to think about that a little bit. And then the native languages were deliberately eradicated by the white man, by the BIA, the churches, and yet when you look back at it in retrospect, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. The BIA, the private schools, and the territories were the types of schools that we had. We were trying to go from a subsistence base to an economic base, and this had quite a bearing on our education at that time, because the people wanted to take the children out camping and gathering food, and this wasn't looked upon too well by the schools. And because of the prejudice here, like the Deep South, I was a real good runner because I lived out by the cottages, and I had to go by no man's land, where's Lincoln Street School, to the old community college. And may not look like it now, but I did run really fast. And that we always prayed that we would not be kept after school. That was incentive to behave yourself. Because if we were kept after school, sure as shooting, we'd have to have a fight or something. And I believe that our parents believed very deeply in education. It was at a great deal of sacrifice that a lot of you today went to school. You did not have your family life, and even though I was within half a mile of my home, I couldn't go home when I wanted to. That was part of the rules of Sheldon Jackson. It was a real good school, like Gil mentioned, and I'll take issue with him that I didn't see any rich people there at SJ. We worked hard. $40 a year for our board was a lot in those days, and I worked there as a missionary, and I think I earned $980 a year or $90 a month. And I believe that one of the major things that really disturbs me is the fact that the eradication of the language was pretty complete. Some of the errors that I'm bringing out are things that I think had a we don't share that with very many people. I had a USO of my own is what I'm talking about. Anyhow, we had worldwide travelers from Sitka at that time. We had new horizons, new thoughts. Integration was beginning to take hold at that time. And the BIA was transplanting a lot of our people down south. And I believe that education has always been crumbs off the table, both from the territory, the BIA, the state, anyone. I don't think we've ever gotten first-class education because the natives were never included in any of the plans that were made in education. It still isn't. I don't think our leaders really have that as a priority. It's pretty evident by the fact that Mount Edgecombe is closed. I believe the discovery of oil had a direct bearing on what happened to us. The high wages and everything was uprooted. And I believe that for a lot of people, welfare was a way of life, because if you couldn't make it, it was better for you to go on welfare. I believe the Molly Hooch case was worked on too fast, no planning. There still isn't any planning. I can't believe that. From the state, from the feds, I think we could probably take the BIA to court because they did not carry out their responsibility in regard to the closure of Mount Edgecombe. Land claims, land rights, that had a definite impact on education. I believe that our leaders were too busy working on the land claims to be concerned about what was happening in education. Therefore, Mount Edgecombe fell through the cracks. And I believe that formal and informal education are really important. I think a lot of us have failed miserably on the informal era. Informal part because that's your television, all the things that kids learn outside of school. We're not the disciplinarians the people were at SJ, and we very well could be. The formal education is just a little tiny bit of the education that we get. And I think a lot of times we put too much emphasis on formal type of education. I've met a lot of weirdos that have their masters and their doctorates, and I've met a lot of nice people like my grandfather, Peter Simpson, who went to the third grade. So I think we need to kind of weigh that out. And Charlie Joseph Sr. is a doctor in my estimation in the Tlingit culture. And another fact about history is a good thing, you know, that when we're not even Indians, because the Indians are over in India, Bill can testify to that, because Columbus made a mistake and thought he was in India. It's a good thing he didn't find Turkey. And Father Oleska, at one of the conferences that I attended, mentioned one of the bad parts about Western culture today. They want everything written, like all this is going to be written. And our culture was oral. And Father Oleska said that the white man likes to draw his line, right? and this and this and this happened. We don't do things that way. Ours was always oral. We always knew what was happening in our history. In the written history, it would be about that much, and all the rest is oral history. All the rest is oral history, yet it is not recognized because it is not a written history. I thought that was really good. History is so slanted, too, because anytime the Indians won, it was a slaughter. Anytime the white man won, it was a victory. Why? And our history books, to a great extent, still do that. And we've had a lot of kids fall through the cracks this year because Mount Edgecombe closed, because we really don't care. Those kids aren't ours over there. Indian education is a national tragedy. I don't know how many of you read that book, the hearings that were held in Washington, D.C. Why do we have why do I have IEA and JOM? A lot of people are ashamed of it. Our kids don't have special needs. They're all right today. I know that there was a lot of people that didn't agree when I started the program because it was an Indian education program. Why do we have that? It's to meet the special needs of Indian children. Do they have special needs? Why is it? I don't know how many of you really could answer that today. And I believe we still have prejudice today, but it's very insidious. I mean, you can't really put your finger on it, but it's there. I still run into it all the time. And I think we have a lot of that are red apples. They're happy to be Indian, I guess, because of the land claims. And we have some that are ashamed of it, and yet they don't really identify with what we have today. Integration, I don't know whether that's good, because we all like to be with our own anyhow. The self-image of our children today, what is it? What do we want? We have a lot of high rate of dropouts. Our health is not very good. A lot of our kids are on alcohol and drugs. Have we, you know, really progressed with the Western culture? We're achieving below level. We're not even average. And I really don't know what to say about education today, because it's better if you don't acknowledge that there's a problem, then you don't have to address it. And I think that's where a lot of us are today. We've lost a lot of young people in suicide. We've lost a lot of our young people because of alcohol. They aren't able to do whatever they had set out to do because of this day and age that we live in. What have we done, you know, to really help us? What is education anyhow? Is this a civilized society that we live in? Because we were called uncivilized, that's why we did not receive our citizenship. And yet look at the crime rate, the slaughter on the highways. A civilized age, and that's what we want. Peter Simpson had said to me, to succeed in this world, you have to be twice as good and work twice as hard as the white man. That was the reality in the day when they were working for whatever they wanted to do. And those people really believed in education. They felt that it's a tool and it was a key that would open many doors. We are slowly advancing, and yet I question a lot of times whether that advancing is good or whether it's bad. And the key to any culture is its language. And yet we really don't care because it's going down the tube. No one has really come out and said, we really want to know our language. And that's the key to keeping our history as natives. Because the language is beautiful and it loses so much in when you're trying to interpret. It's a genocide of the language that I think I would be most concerned about. And I believe Gil made a real good statement there in regard to what we say about the missionaries and the BIA. As a mother, I know the birth of a child is so difficult, yet when that child is born, it's a tremendously joyful feeling that you have. And I believe that if the Tlingits hadn't been put in the area that we were, where we gave up our ways, that we would not be the foremost leaders today. That's debatable. That's my own assumption because of the things that I've done. I believe that we lack leaders with integrity and with values today. I think money and power is what ANSCA has brought us. I don't think any of us have really searched ourselves out as to what we feel we want for our children tomorrow, much less today. What is success? What is identity? Where there is no vision.
Thank you, Isabel. The rebirth of Indian self-determination and relationship of Native organizations in Sitka. Bill Brady.
Thank you, Ellen. Justice Berger. I'm going to time myself because I want to speak about 2 minutes less than Gil Truett spoke. I'm trying to think of a couple of ways to get back at him, but I think I'll save that. I think this is a very serious occasion. We'd like to thank the Native Review Commission for coming to Sitka so they can listen to us talk about some of the background leading up to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. There are several statements here. I think one of the things that a lot of our own people in the state of Alaska fail to realize or haven't realized, or they had not been informed, is the fact that the only battles fought with foreigners, as we call them, was here in Sitka in 1802 and 1804. And neither of these two battles did we lose. We retreated strategically and again came back. History of Sitka, one of the native Tlingit names for uptown was Nuuke, or inside a fort. The Russians had to build a fort, palisade, stockade, whatever you want to call it, around their settlement to keep those wild Tlingits out of their hair. But as was said, they did have high respect for our culture. And my understanding in reading back on the purchase was the fact that the Russians did not sell the land. They sold the rights to the United States to trade with the people of the country. And contrary to what all other ethnic groups might say about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, Congress, in all its wisdom, finally recognized the fact that they did take something away from us that did not belong to them. And by the very fact that they paid us close to $1 million for a state that is one-fifth the size of the United States, just wasn't quite enough. There are a lot of other things I could probably go into, but I'll reserve that for tomorrow when I make my own personal comment. Tonight I'm speaking for the Sitka Community Association, of which I am president, and for a living I'm the deputy director of the Sitka Council on Alcoholism. I don't know if I should tell this or not, but I will anyway before I get into it. This was told by a Presbyterian minister in one of the gatherings down south where Jesus Christ had come back to earth and was walking down a street, and he saw an individual sitting on a curb and crying, and Jesus walked up to him and said, "What's the trouble, my good man?" And the man said, "I've been blind since birth, and I would like to see what's going on around this country of ours." Well, Jesus put his hand on his head and said, "You can see again, my son." And the man was able to see. He walked a little further down the road and saw another man sitting on a curb, asked him what his problem was. And the man also was crying, and he said, "I've been crippled since birth," and Jesus put his hand on his head and healed him. He walked another half a block and saw another man sitting there on the curb crying. And as he did with the first, he asked what the problem was. The man looked at him, tears streaming down his face, and he said, "I'm an Indian." And Jesus Christ sat down with him and cried with him. Sometime I feel that this is a fact because we seem to run into one thing after the other that just quite doesn't go with our traditional upbringings. And one of them, of course, is the Native Claims Settlement Act. The Sitka Community Association was chartered in 1938 under the Indian Reorganization Act. At that particular time, we had to have a principal teacher in attendance at all of the meetings to make sure that everything was carried on in proper manner. And we also had the Constitution and bylaws drawn up at that time. Basically, what was organized for at the time was a re-lending organization for monies coming from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the money was then loaned to individuals in Sitka to purchase fishing boats. I don't know the exact amount at this time. At the time, I guess it was a horrendous amount and equaled right around $45,000. It finally failed, fell down the tube, fishing became bad, whatever happened, it just didn't seem to work out, and Sitka Community Association was dormant for a number of years until 1975, when the association reorganized right in this hall. One of the very first things we did in the reorganization, we went to the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Alaska Native Sisterhood, the Tlingit and Haida, and Asiatica Incorporated, the local land claim corporation. And we had letters of support from these four other Indian organizations to reorganize ourselves. We started off very, very slowly looking through everything before we jumped, and we began to get contracts from the various organizations, mainly BIA. We have gone through a lot. We've did some table pounding and fighting. Meanwhile, keeping a close eye on what was happening to our own Shattuck Incorporated. Unfortunately, there were several things that happened immediately on our land selection, because we started to look around in the beginning for Shiatica and found that everything close to home had already been either bought by ALP or other logging outfits, or it had been already logged over, and the closest we could get to within Sitka was an Admiralty Island. There were a number of selections made, and I won't go into the detail of the whole thing, but finally we heard the good news that finally we're going to get 23,000 acres we can start logging on. A bunch of things happened, unfortunately still happening, and more good news, which you'll hear about later. We have probably begun to move in a direction currently of the Sitka Community Association and Shiatica working, where we have leased two islands over on the Mount Edgecombe complex from Shiatica for a period of 5 years, or at any given time they feel that they can take over and begin enterprises. Currently, the Sitka Community Association have a number of buildings renovated over there for rental purposes to our Indian families who were displaced when the Mount Edgecombe school closed. We've had a number of grants come in. We're still working on the water and sewage systems over there through the association, because we were the recognized tribal entity in Sitka. Entity is what many of the government agencies call us. We still call ourselves a tribe, and we are recognized as such, only because we have to work within the framework of this huge bureaucracy that has been mentioned time and again this evening. I suppose there are times I feel that we've learned bureaucracy to the point where we can out-bureaucrat our teachers, and this happens to us occasionally. Thanks for teaching of people like Gil Truitt, who is a teacher. I'd like to read some things. I have a lot here, and I'll just touch a high spots, and I'll turn in these written statements to the commission. But I would like to read this one particular section. The traditional law governed the people of Southeast Alaska from time immemorial to well after the turn of the 20th century. Russian rule was confined to the immediate areas of their trade-oriented settlements, leaving most villages to govern themselves. For nearly half For nearly a half century after the American purchase of Alaska in 1867, there was literally no civil government under American law. Traditional law among the Tlingit and Haida people was a well-constructed body of mandates and prohibitions, which can be compared to the English common law concepts of contract and tort. This body of ethnic law was an effective instrument for the settlements of dispute and for social and economic control for many centuries. I imagine for many centuries would probably mean this goes back to the second migration occurring shortly after the advent of the second ice age when it receded, which would put it back about 9,000 years. With the advent of the federal bureaucracy, the population of Southeast Alaska found itself confronted with yet another legal system which was imposed over traditional law, but which by no means displaced it. The traditional home rule by the clans, tribes, was similarly disrupted but not displaced. Public Law 93638, the Indian Self-Determination Act, provided the means to resume the interrupted home rule the self-governing people of the Sitka tribe had clung to through the years of bureaucratic control. The act was implemented by the Sitka tribe in 1975. Public Law 95608, the Indian Child Welfare Act, provided the vehicle for the resumption of tribal exercise of self-government most viable to outside observers, the tribal court. Further, it provided an immediate re-experiencing of home rule for the tribal council. The council itself is an evolutionary body which exercises the authority previously held by clan elders in the terms of visible government. The elders retain a voice of authority for the respective clans. In 1981, the council began a series of delegations of power under home rule, which can be shown in the following testimony to the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs. As a result of Public Law 95608, the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Sitka Community Association Federal Indian Tribe wishes to apprise the committee on the following. Number one, this tribe has been funded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs for Indian Child Welfare programming for 3 years at a level of $50,000 a year. Funding is to cover the salary of one child welfare worker plus minimal direct service budget for legal assistance to children and families coming within the act and for adoptive subsidies to Indian families. Three, to meet part of the gap in needed services, the Alaska Native Brotherhood Sitka Camp 1 and the American Legion Sitka Post 13 have responded to requests for money support to the extent that their modest resources allow. Number four, the tribe has applied for and obtained community services block grant funds from the Department of Health and Human Services to further supplement the available funding. Five, as a tribal response to the act, the tribal council delegated to the tribal Children's and Domestic Relations Court a portion of the traditional decision-making powers of the council. And six, to support the efforts of the Tribal Children's Court and the Domestic Relations Court, a Sitka Community Association Tribal Indian Child Welfare Agency was created by the council to provide supervision and services to children and families before the court, to effect permanency planning where possible, provide services to families in crisis and or at risk for maintenance of family integrity, and to serve as a court liaison with state agencies. Seven, as a result of block grant funding, the tribe has developed and enacted a children's code, domestic relations code, standards of care outside the home for children, and a civil code, Work is going on with U.S. Children's Bureau and with the help of a small grant from that agency to upgrade codes and standards of care. Judge Jim Bone of the Puyallup Indian Court is our interface consultant in this effort. And this is the sad part. The state of Alaska does not recognize our tribe or its jurisdiction within the act. At a local level, however, the State Department of Family and Youth Services has been most cooperative in notifying the tribe of children and families coming before the state superior court and in mutual case planning to provide services to such children and families within the intent and meaning of the law. There have been over 100 such notifications and mutual planning efforts over the 3-year funding period. Number 9, there are approximately 600 members of the Sitka tribe in absentee status in other states than Alaska. We have handled court cases in Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, and New Mexico on behalf of children of the tribe before those courts. Full faith and recognition has been extended mutually in all cases outside Alaska, a total of 46 at this writing. We have been successful in all cases outside of Alaska, one of which required appellate action to the Supreme Court of the United States. In 2 of the cases in the South 48, it was necessary to hold tribal court hearings in those states. In 1, a judge pro tem was appointed to hear the case for the tribe, and in the 2nd, our court was extended physical facilities by reciprocating state of Oregon. Both actions were successful in restoring children to Indian families. Our tribe engages the services of competent Indian practitioners to give services and supervision to children in responding states where return of the families and or children to Alaska would place a burden on the Indian families. In 3 instances, children have been returned to the tribe as a result of actions by other state courts, but not as transfers of jurisdiction. In each instance, the tribe was asked to monitor the case of the reciprocating state court and to act for that court. This was accomplished with a resultant reestablishment of intact Indian families in each case. Despite the non-recognition of the tribal court program by the state of Alaska, the Sitka Superior Court and the Sitka Bar require notification to the tribe and a written report to the Superior Court from the tribe in all native adoptions coming before the Superior Court. A full adoption review is provided by the Tribal Indians Child Welfare Agency as an arm of the tribal court in all such cases. These have totaled over 43 in a past 3-year period. The tribe has approached the state of Alaska to attempt to reach an administrative agreement of children's matters through the governor. The concept paper is sent by the tribe is attached. No action has been taken by the state at this writing, although we are assured the matter is under study, and this has been 3 months. In summary, the Indian Child Welfare Act is working. Even with inadequate funding to completely access the intent of the act, this tribe has succeeded in carefully selecting cases on a most in need and most chance of success basis and has been gratified with the results. The intent of the act is to prevent the breakup of Indian families and provide intervention before the need for court action exists. We are making measurable progress in that direction. The present competitive grant process for the ICW monies used by the Bureau of Indian Affairs tends to reward those tribes which can afford grant writers and to deprive those tribes most in need of the Indian child welfare programs. The method for securing BIA legal help to help Indian families and children before the court is too cumbersome and too slow to provide such help within a normal notice period for process used by a majority of courts. We, the tribes of Alaska, need help desperately in securing recognition of tribal jurisdiction in family and children matters by the state of Alaska. The full intent of the act will never be achieved without such recognition. Those funds presently used for care of Indian children and service to Indian families by the state of Alaska from federal sources should be made available to the tribes for provision of those services in a culturally relevant context under tribal programming. And the closing statement on this to the committee was, as one impact of ANCSA, the state of Alaska views the act of extinguishing tribal entities and tribal authorities. Our position is that ANCSA does not contain such language, nor is there any evidence that such was the intent of the Congress. The state couples ANCSA and Public Law 280 to justify the state position. PL 280 does grant exclusive criminal jurisdiction and some limited civil jurisdiction to the state, but the tribes retain most civil jurisdiction. We do not need criminal jurisdiction. Civil remedies and control satisfy all of the needs of the tribes. Our codes are civil. Our use of traditional law is civil. This suffices for a full exercise of home rule and self-government. I think the process, the thought behind the whole thing can be summed up in a statement that we wrote out here. And what we're talking about is home rule and self-government that does not require a land base. Home rule and self-government do not require reservation status. Home rule and self-government do require an identifiable group of people who are self-determining. Only through an adequate and ongoing enrollment process can this be maintained. Membership in this tribe is not an empty exercise. Not only is the cultural heritage protected, but tribal protection benefits and services are available to tribal members wherever they may be found. Our record of services to members in the South 48 attests to this. Currently, an estimation that of the 2,200 tribal members that we service in the Sitka area, approximately 40% or more are not Sitka Indian tribe members, but they are enrolled in the Sitka tribe. Part of this testimony, I think, is to kind of tie together those things that are now being mentioned. I am not sure who has mentioned this, and I won't even assume to guess, but I think there is a point in time immediately where the for-profit corporations and also the tribes get their